Do nuclear weapons equal nuclear security? That's what the 9 nuclear-armed states would like you to believe, citing their necessity for deterrence and promising no first use, both of which are coded self-permissions to one day cross that line and use them. The bomb-possessing countries will try to shut down any conversation on the matter by saying, don't bother talking about the negative consequences of using a nuclear weapon because, hey, we need them for national security. But then you hear from a genuine expert, a woman who sits in the global nuclear catbird seat, overlooking all the international nuclear posturing and messaging and false claims that attempt to control the conversation. And she tells you,
the fact is that talking about catastrophic humanitarian and environmental consequences is talking about security, talking about the total destruction of infrastructure, the economy, the environment, the death of millions of people through blast, burns, and radiation, and billions of people through starvation in a nuclear winter, is very much talking about security. And I think the more important question is, how sustainable are security policies that rely on weapons, any use of which would be not only genocidal but also suicidal?
Well, when Melissa Park, executive director of the Nobel Peace Prize-winning International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, a woman who knows and sees and communicates the international existential threat posed by nuclear weapons while striving for their complete abolition, you get a more complete and complex picture of the terrible risk they pose to life on Earth and why there continues to be an awful, dangerous, deadly seat that all of us share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a very special interview with Melissa Park. She is executive director of the Nobel Peace Prize-winning International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN. In the middle of the commemoration ceremonies in Japan, marking the 80th anniversaries of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki by the United States, Melissa took time to talk with us from Nagasaki, where she minced no words in laying out where we are, how bad things are, and what we can do and are doing about it. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, the return of Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, Jack Cohen Joppa of the Nuclear Resistor with another story from our history of successful activist resistance, and more honest nuclear information than is likely to be discussed during Trump and Putin's Zelensky-less meeting in Alaska. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, August 12, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S. and beyond, accelerated plans announced by NASA this month call for accelerating a push to put a nuclear reactor on the moon ahead of China and Russia. But the vastness of space is governed by long-standing legal frameworks, parts of which have yet to be tested. NASA's efforts in that realm raise thorny questions about those rules and the possibility for conflict as countries vie for a stepping stone on the path to Mars and beyond. Sean P. Duffy, the acting administrator of NASA and the U.S. Transportation Secretary, has asked NASA to accelerate efforts to place a nuclear reactor on the moon by 2030. The reactor technology will, quote, support a future lunar economy, high-power energy generation on Mars, and strengthen our national security in space. And as the first country to place a nuclear energy source on the moon, the U.S., quote, could declare a keep-out zone, which appears to be a step towards staking out extraterrestrial property as exclusively belonging to the United States. We will tell you more about Stephen Colbert's response to this in our activist shout-out section. And that's not the only location looking to plant a nuke. Here's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
Denver International Airport is considering the deployment of a small modular nuclear reactor as part of its goal of becoming, quote, the greenest airport in the world, end quote. Now they are actively seeking a request for proposals to study the feasibility of building said small modular nuclear reactor on the airport campus, a move which will cost approximately $1.25 million. Oh, where to start? First of all, you can't deploy technology that doesn't exist, and small modular nuclear reactors don't exist. None has been built, let alone tested, let alone approved by the recently neutered Nuclear Regulatory Commission, so there's no technology. Secondly, how dare you call nukes green? Didn't we put that lie to rest a long time ago? How can something be considered a green energy source when it creates in its waste stream highly radioactive, plutonium-contaminated waste that is deadly to life for 250,000 years? That's not green, guys. And citing it at an airport? A new 12-step program is needed for nuclear hopium, because all of this and so much more adds up to this being a really bad idea. Still, Denver Airport CEO Phil Washington said, "We recognize the technology is still relatively new." No, not new, Phil. It doesn't exist. He goes on to say, "There is much to learn." Yeah, like all the reasons this is a really bad idea. And that's why CEO Phil Washington and Denver International Airport, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
In keeping with this, we will link to an article entitled, "These Nuclear Reactors Fit on a Flatbed Truck. How Safe Are They?" We will link to it on our website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 737. Over to Japan, where despite the ongoing recognition of 80 years since the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and cries to end nuclear weapons, nuclear reactor technology keeps barreling ahead in the country, unaware of the connection between the two. 12 years after Fukushima, Japan is planning to build a new nuclear reactor, despite ongoing outcry from those who were harmed by that nuclear disaster. Kansai Electric is, depending on which report you read, either planning to or considering building a new nuclear reactor. This potential development could mark the end of a 13-year hiatus in nuclear reactor construction in Japan that followed the destruction of the Fukushima nuclear power station and the meltdown of 3 of its reactors. Moving on to Pakistan, where a senior Pakistani military official on a visit to the United States vowed to respond forcibly to any escalation by India following their brief but intense military confrontation in May in the disputed Kashmir region in the Himalayas. Field Marshal Asim Munir, the Pakistan Army's chief of staff, said that any mistake by neighboring India could trigger a catastrophic conflict between the two nuclear-armed rivals. His remarks were widely reported by the Indian press, and New Delhi responded on Monday by describing them as nuclear blackmail. While not specifically nuclear in nature, Munir also threatened to destroy India's dam projects on the Indus River, saying that Pakistan would fire missiles on the dam once constructed. There are many details and a lot of backstory on this that we don't have time for right here, so we will link to the story on our website, nuclearhotseat.com. The episode is number 737. Our esteemed nuclear eminence Grise, and longtime friend and mentor to Nuclear Hot Seat, award-winning environmental journalist Carl Grossman, made a presentation entitled No Nukes for Power, Posturing, or Destruction. It was put forth at a Hiroshima-Nagasaki commemorative event on Long Island that was organized by a coalition of peace groups and religious institutions. He started with a quote from Dr. Helen Caldicott, a medical doctor, a revered anti-nuclear activist, and author of books including Nuclear Madness, published in 1978, and The New Nuclear Danger, which was out just 3 years ago. She declared, "We are in the hands of lunatics and at the crossroads of time. It's time we rise up and say, this is our world we want to live." Carl then spent the next hour elaborating, and we are privileged to have his notes from the presentation, which we will link to on our website. We will also link to an article from the New York Post, of all places, which cites what it calls a startling new study that reveals nuclear winter would bring mass starvation and death for years post-war, something which those of us who oppose nukes have known about for a very long time and didn't require a startling new study to reveal it to us. But the headline goes on to say, we must be prepared. As if there is really no way to prepare for planetary annihilation. Now, back from her sabbatical to finish her book, which will be published next March, is Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story. Here she talks about how the power of words and images serve as a lesson from Hiroshima.
I have heard the renowned Hibakusha Setsuko Thurlow tell her story many times. She was 13 when the atomic bomb fell on her city of Hiroshima. She has been describing her experience of surviving it almost ever since, and to profound effect. If you are not familiar with Setsuko, there are many videos of her online telling her story, including during the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize-winning ceremony, when she was there to accept the prize with the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, the network of organizations from around the world that received it. I never cease to be moved and appalled by what Setsuko endured, and reminded of two things in particular, the power of words and the dangers of censorship. When she speaks, she conjures vivid images of what she and others around her endured and suffered, but the actual images themselves were deliberately suppressed by the US government for decades. Unlike the photos and footage taken during the liberation of the Nazi death camps, for example, which served as vital evidence during the trials at Nuremberg of the perpetrators, Americans did not see what their country had done in Japan until 1970, and no one has ever stood trial for those crimes against humanity. At 7:15 p.m. on August 5th, which was 8:15 a.m. the next day in Japan, the time the Hiroshima bomb struck the city, a group of us went, as we do every year, to the Japanese-American Memorial in Washington, D.C. The memorial is also a tribute to the Japanese-Americans who were interned in concentration camps in the U.S. during World War II, another gross violation of human rights. On one of the walls is an inscription by the late Democratic Senator from Hawaii, Daniel Inouye. It reads, "The lessons learned must remain a grave reminder of what we must not allow to happen again to any group." That was certainly a message that resonated hard for those of us gathered that evening, calling for peace and kindness. One of those assembled with us was a Japanese daughter of Hiroshima survivors who told us her story. Again, we were shocked because it delivered yet another perspective on what inhumanity can look like. Both her parents survived, but her older sister, around 6 weeks old at the time of the blast, died a short time later. Her father, badly burned, was treated for his wounds, but was also asked to have another baby. It was a grand experiment to see what would happen if two people directly exposed by the Hiroshima bombing produced a child. She was that child. The doctors who treated her parents were not really interested in their welfare. They were interested in them as specimens, as guinea pigs. It reminded me of the way the Marshallese were subsequently treated after the US exploded 67 atomic bombs over their lands too. Here is what Merrill Eisenbud, then the director of the US Atomic Energy Agency's Health and Safety Laboratory, said about the Marshallese who returned far too soon to their irradiated island of Rongelap in 1956, 2 years after they were evacuated. That island is by far the most contaminated place on Earth, and it will be very interesting to get a measure of human uptake when people live in a contaminated environment. While it is true that these people do not live the way Westerners do, civilized people, it is nevertheless also true that these people are more like us than mice. That was Eisenbud's statement. Treating other people as if they were vermin got us the horrors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and Vietnam and now Gaza. Rejecting nuclear weapons as the horrific instruments of cruelty that they are is a brave and necessary step in declaring ourselves beyond such depravity. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's Hot Story.
Linda Pence-Gunter, great to have you back. We'll have this week's featured interview with Melissa Park of ICANN in just a moment. But first, the 80th anniversaries of the atomic bombings by the United States of Hiroshima and Nagasaki are past. But the nuclear danger continues and is even greater than it was 80 years ago. That's because the weapons we have now are magnitudes larger than the two used on Japan. Our fear of using them is less, and saber-rattling by nuclear states is on the rise. Yes, there are many other troubling conflicts and issues in the world, but nuclear is ultimate because its impact on life, health, and DNA is forever. And it's not just the bombs. Radiation released from the entire nuclear fuel chain, uranium mining, manufacture of weapons and nuclear reactors, operation of reactors, and highly radioactive waste, these will all continue to pose a threat to life for tens of thousands of years. No one is immune, so the decisions made now, the actions taken today, can have consequences beyond our imagining. That is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We keep you up to date on not only what's going on with the nuclear industry and governments, but what you can do about it. Every week, we bring you the kind of nuclear information that mainstream media just doesn't seem to have the heart, or time, or money to put on the air or in print. Our stories have been sourced, checked, and footnoted, and then we add interviews with genuine experts to fill in the picture. We also tell you about the triumphs and challenges of activists on the front lines against nuclear around the world. But we can't keep doing this work without your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs exclusively on donations, and we need yours right now. You can make it a one-time donation or a monthly recurring gift of any amount to support what it takes to keep this show running. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax-deductible. And we make it easy for you to do. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com. Click on the red donate button, or you can send a donation directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Any amount helps, so please don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate now, and know that whatever you can do to help, my thanks and my gratitude. Now here's this week's featured interview. The Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the TPNW, also known as the Nuclear Weapons Ban Treaty, is the first legally binding international agreement to comprehensively prohibit nuclear weapons, with the ultimate goal being their total elimination. For those nations that are party to it, this treaty prohibits the development, testing, production, stockpiling, stationing, transfer, use, and threat of use of nuclear weapons, as well as assistance and encouragement to the prohibited activities. The moving force behind the TPNW is the Nobel Peace Prize-winning International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN. And the executive director of ICAN is today's interviewee, Melissa Park. She is a former Australian Minister for International Development and former Member of Parliament for the Australian Labour Party. As an MP, she regularly voiced support for nuclear disarmament, including as a member of a cross-party parliamentary group dedicated to the cause. She has been the head of ICAN for almost 2 years. This past week, as the world commemorated the 80th anniversary of the U.S. dropping atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it seems that there could be no better time to talk about the ongoing nuclear threat to life, health, and the environment. Melissa Park was in Japan to take part in the commemorations and participate in a range of events. But she generously carved out time to speak with us while in Nagasaki the day after the Hiroshima commemoration. I spoke with Melissa Park on August 7, 2025. Melissa Park, we are so pleased and honored to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you very much for having me here again. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It is, of course, obvious that I can be represented at these anniversary events of the bombings, the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In the planning of this journey, which also included time spent in New Mexico at the Trinity site, which is where the first bomb test took place.
Yes.
What was the thinking that went into setting this up? And what is your hope? What is the intention for what can be achieved by it?
Well, the reason we went to New Mexico first was because we wanted to tell the story, the narrative arc of how all of this began. And of course, if we really want to tell a story, we need to go back to New York, Manhattan, of course, where the in Chicago and the Congo, where the uranium was mined for the Manhattan Project. I mean, you can go back much further, but the very first use of nuclear weapons was in New Mexico. And we wanted to highlight that and bring that to the world's attention because there are people there. It was not empty desert, as the government claimed. No, it was home to families and children and workers and farmers from various local, including indigenous communities. It had very rich animal and plant life and cultural heritage and sacred sites. And all of that was ignored. The communities nearby, like Tularosa, for example, were not evacuated or even warned in advance and, well, basically been ignored. And the recent RECA bill, which did expand to include New Mexico, certainly a good step towards some justice for those people who've been fighting for decades because of the intergenerational cancers and birth defects and other radiation-related illnesses they've had been having to deal with it. But the big so-called beautiful bill that RECA was part of also, you know, took away Medicaid. And 40% of New Mexicans are actually in receipt of Medicaid. It's one of the poorest states in the US, and yet billions of dollars, like $10 billion a year, is spent by the Department of Energy in New Mexico on nuclear weapons research and development and waste management. And none of that makes it into the local communities. New Mexico's public education system is almost last. It's got the homelessness was rife everywhere I went, apart from Los Alamos, which is one of the richest counties in the country. So that county is doing very well, but the rest of New Mexico is very poor. Anyway, we wanted to tell the story. We wanted to say about this year is that it marks 80 years since the US invented and first used nuclear weapons in New Mexico, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And of course, the bombs here killed and injured hundreds of thousands of people, including children, and caused massive intergenerational and environmental harm. And since 1945, there have been more than 2,000 nuclear weapons explosions carried out as so-called tests by the nuclear armed states around the world. that have harmed millions of people and their environments in such places as Algeria, my home country of Australia, Kazakhstan, Kiribati, French Polynesia, the Marshall Islands, Nevada. And nuclear survivors around the world have experienced generations of cancers and other related illnesses, but also discrimination, permanent contamination of their homelands, and they've struggled for recognition, medical support, compensation, and access to information. So we wanted to tell this story about, so what we're commemorating here in Japan this week is not two isolated historical events of 80 years ago that have little relevance to today, but actually 80 years of catastrophic, indiscriminate, widespread, ongoing harm to people and the environment. And the message from nuclear survivors around the world, but also including the Japanese and the Korean Hibakusha, because remembering that some 10 to 20% of the victims of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were Korean. Their message is that nuclear justice and true human security can only come from getting rid of these inhumane weapons. And so I've been here in Hiroshima and Nagasaki this week, and next week I'll be in Busan and Hapcheon in South Korea to continue to listen to the Hibakusha there and to uplift their voices at this important moment in history, and to say that it's thanks to the testimonies of the Hibakusha that we have the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or TPNW, which provides the pathway under international law for fair and verifiable nuclear disarmament and provides for victim assistance and environmental remediation for communities impacted by nuclear weapons. Half of all countries in the world have now have joined the treaty, and we're looking forward to more joining in the near future, which means the treaty will have the global majority of nations in the world saying to the nuclear armed states, "You have put us through 80 years of harm and danger. It is time to give up your nuclear weapons."
You spoke of the Korean Hibakusha, and they are a group that have not been part of the conversation. Certainly, this is the first year I have heard anything about them in connection with Nuclear Hot Seat. You attended a ceremony and events on August 5th with Korean survivors of the atomic bombing. What was that like? Why are we only hearing about this now? And how are the Korean survivors being folded into the larger and more familiar narrative of the Japanese survivors?
The situation of the Korean survivors is complex because the reason the Koreans were in Japan at the time of the bombings is that many of them were there as forced labor, forced by the Japanese, who were colonizers, occupiers of Korea. And some of them were there as migrants because there were no economic opportunities in Korea at the time. And it's something that some Japanese don't want to really talk about it because then they have to acknowledge Japan's role in how the Koreans were treated. And a lot of Koreans don't see, they see the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki as having brought the war and Japan's occupation to an end. So they see it as sad for the people who were impacted by the nuclear bombings, but good for Koreans because they got their independence back. And so it's a very different conversation in Korea than it is in Japan. And so it's actually Japanese Hibakusha and Japanese people who have tended to be more supportive of the Korean Hibakusha because they understand about the significance of having been bombed with nuclear weapons. Whereas the Koreans in Korea who weren't in Japan at the time, they just see it as a sort of something that helped them get out of from under Japan's control. So it wasn't all bad. And there's a very different debate about nuclear weapons in Korea. You know, a lot of politicians and the public quite supportive of the idea of Korea having its own nuclear weapons. They don't have the same stigma attached to them that they do in Japan. And we think it's really important that Koreans learn about the catastrophic humanitarian and environmental consequences of nuclear weapons so that they can see that, nuclear weapons are not the path to security. Getting rid of them is the path to security. And so that's why we felt it was critical to also go to Korea and talk to the communities there and talk to the media as well about this issue. As for why this year, I guess the 80th anniversaries have brought all of this stuff up, more prominently. And I know the Korean Hibakusha they've been calling for justice for a long time. And it is true that now their voices are starting to come out. And I really don't know exactly why, but it might have something to do with the 80th anniversary.
The first time I heard of them was at events that were held as part of the meetings on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons at the UN earlier this year. And it was completely new information to me, so I'm hoping to be able to cover it more fully in upcoming episodes of the show. Now, the public ceremony on the 6th of August in Hiroshima at Hiroshima Peace Memorial is an annual event. Of course, this being the 80th year, there was tremendous significance to it. What was it like for you to be there? What were your thoughts? What were your feelings as you were there and experiencing it with everyone else?
It was extremely moving, to think that 80 years at that exact moment was when, a quarter of a million people lost their lives and many more were harmed. And that's sort of, together with the Trinity explosion, sort of started the whole nuclear age of harm and existential danger. It was very moving. To listen, the governor of Hiroshima gave an incredible speech where he really talked about the danger of nuclear deterrence, of the theory of nuclear deterrence and how false it is and how dangerous it is and how we have to get through to nuclear armed states about what they're doing by supporting this theory. It was great. I was sitting next to Alexander Kmet, the Austrian ambassador for disarmament, who had been the president of the first meeting of states parties of the TPNW in Vienna. And he, this last year, has been chairing a study on the security concerns of the states parties, of states that don't have nuclear weapons, and how deterrence is putting all the world's countries and peoples at risk. And he said that the speech that the governor of Hiroshima gave, basically a lot of that information was taken from the report that his group presented at the third meeting of states parties in New York in March this year. So, and it is available on the UN website for anyone to read. And it's a brilliant report, which totally takes apart deterrence. And it's worth reading. It's just so well put together. And so, it makes it very clear that as long as nuclear weapons remain anywhere, they're going to be used one day by design or by accident. And we know that there have been a long list of accidents and nuclear near misses where the world could have ended but for luck. And we can't rely on luck to last indefinitely. Of course, the most important aspect of the 6th of August ceremony was just to be there with the Hibakusha and with other people who really care about this issue, to show solidarity with everyone who's ever been harmed by nuclear weapons and with everyone who wants to see a world without nuclear weapons.
For those listening who might not be familiar with the alternative take on deterrence, it's touted as being the only way that we can protect ourselves, yada, yada. When you say deterrence, explain what it is that you mean.
Well, nuclear deterrence, simply put, means the willingness and readiness of nuclear armed states to inflict indiscriminate, catastrophic harm on millions of innocent people and the environment as a way of deterring attacks. The very possession of nuclear weapons poses a constant and unacceptable threat to humanity. There was an Australian former foreign minister, Gareth Evans, who co-chaired the International Commission on Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament, along with the former Japanese Foreign Minister Yoriko Kawaguchi. Gareth said, keeping stockpiles of nuclear weapons is not a risk-free enterprise, even if you only intend to use them by way of retaliation. The deterrent utility of nuclear weapons is illusory, and the risk of retaining nuclear weapons far outweighs any benefit from having them. So he said that. The quote that I love the most, because I think it sums it all up, is the one from Joseph Rotblat, who was one of the early nuclear scientists on the Manhattan Project and the only one to leave it for moral reasons, who went on to campaign for nuclear disarmament and won the Nobel Peace Prize. He said about nuclear deterrence that it is the ultimate form of terrorism. And it is. That's exactly what it is. It's holding the world to ransom. And the thing is, as Gareth said, I mean, even if you don't ever intend to use them, except by way of retaliation, and even that would be contrary to international law and morality, because you're inflicting, you know, one atrocity does not excuse another. But even if that's, you know, things happen, accidents happen. You know, there are more than 50 nuclear weapons sitting at the bottom of the ocean that have fallen out of planes, rolled off of ships, sunk with nuclear submarines. We've had incidents where the moonlight, flying swans, reflections off of clouds have been mistaken in radar detection equipment, and they've been mistaken for incoming missiles, and training exercises have been mistaken as the real thing. And so these sorts of things have happened in the past and could have ended in disaster. And it's only been really luck, or having a person who was prepared, as Stanislav Petrov was, prepared to go against his own country's protocols and not elevate the issue to see that there was a counterattack from Russia. And, you know, he was hailed at the UN as the man who saved the earth, but he was not treated well in Russia because he hadn't followed the protocol, even though it would have meant, you know, the end of the world. So the fact is that deterrence is a very, it's a psychological concept, relying upon 100% rationality and predictability of all actors, including one's enemies, 100% of the time, relying upon full knowledge of the enemy's intentions. You know, we know that human beings frequently don't act rationally, and machines can make mistakes as humans can. You know, you can't deter mistakes and miscalculations. You can't deter unhinged leaders and cyber attacks. You know, there are so many things that cannot be deterred. And so naturally, even if deterrence might work sometimes, it manifestly won't work all the time. And that means that when you've got weapons that can destroy humanity, that risk is not acceptable. These weapons have to be eliminated. That's the only way to eliminate the existential threat they pose.
All it takes is one mistake, and deterrence means absolutely nothing except disaster.
Yep.
With the intensity of the meetings you've been in, the conversations you've been having, what primacy, what attention is being paid to the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons?
Quite a lot, actually, given that the mayor of Hiroshima and the governor of Hiroshima, the Hibakusha, are speaking about the TPNW and wanting Japan, in particular, as the only nation to have been attacked with nuclear weapons in wartime, to exercise its unique moral leadership and join the TPNW and advocate for total nuclear disarmament. But, I mean, Japan cannot credibly do that while it retains a reliance on US nuclear weapons in its defense policy. But it's interesting. You know, you get some commentators and groups in the US who will say, well, The TPNW is, it's a nice humanitarian approach, but it's not based on real security. And a lot of the nuclear armed states will say that too. But the fact is that talking about catastrophic humanitarian and environmental consequences is talking about security, talking about the total destruction of infrastructure, the economy, the environment, the death of millions of people through blast, burns and radiation, and billions of people through starvation in a nuclear winter, is very much talking about security. And I think the more important question is, how sustainable are security policies that rely on weapons, any use of which would be not only genocidal but also suicidal? So, no, we're hearing a lot of talk about the TPNW, and it's notable that the Hibakusha, the ones, who really know the reality of nuclear weapons, they're not calling for risk reduction. They're calling for the elimination of nuclear weapons. They're not calling for half measures. Of course, we want to see risks reduced immediately. We want to see weapons taken off of high alert launch status. We want to see arsenals being reduced. This has to start somewhere. But the ultimate ambition has to be the elimination, not just like risk reduction for its own sake. And let's face it, I mean, the nuclear armed states are not even interested in risk reduction. They're not doing anything. They won't take their weapons off of high alert launch status because they say it'll reduce the credibility of their deterrent. They're not actually going to do anything that will meaningfully reduce risk. And so really, I think, you can get bogged down in a whole risk reduction scenario, but ultimately we have to get rid of these weapons. And I know that there's a big push from some people to have declarations of no first use. No first use, the problem with it, there's a credibility problem with no first use, because any country that's willing to use nuclear weapons to indiscriminately kill millions of innocent people, which is the inherent aspect of nuclear deterrence, is probably also willing to break a promise not to use them first. And more importantly, we think that any use of nuclear weapons, even by way of retaliation, is legally and morally unacceptable. Retaliatory use would have the same catastrophic consequences. And the other thing is, does anyone believe it would be acceptable to have a no first use policy on chemical or biological weapons or any other kind of inhumane weapon? And if not, why is it different for the worst weapons of all, nuclear weapons? Would it be acceptable to have a no first mass rape policy or a no first genocide policy? The general principle is the same, that one atrocity doesn't excuse another. And the TPNW is a no use treaty. It doesn't distinguish between first use and retaliatory use, and I don't think we should either. Everybody to their own views, I suppose, but that's how we see it. And we think the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons is the path forward for the international community on disarmament issues. And there's really nothing happening anywhere else on this issue. This is where it is happening.
As we are talking, you are in Nagasaki, and the ceremonies there, the commemorative ceremonies, will be taking place there tomorrow, your tomorrow, my day after tomorrow. We're working with time zones here. It will be taking place tomorrow in Nagasaki. Do you expect there to be an appreciable difference between the kinds of ceremonies or the way the ceremony plays out in Nagasaki than it did in Hiroshima?
I mean, I can't really say, because this is the first time I've been to the ceremonies. This will be the first time to go to the Nagasaki one, as it was the first time for me to go to the Hiroshima one.
Pardon me, I assumed that you had been there before, probably many times.
Would expect that their message would be the same about the importance of the elimination of nuclear weapons and the importance of continuing to carry the message of the Hibakusha forward, so that even as they get older and pass on, that their message remains. Yeah, so I expect that that will be what it will be like, but it will be interesting to see. I mean, they are very different cities. For instance, I think a lot of people don't know that Nagasaki has a sort of significant Catholic population. I don't know if there might be some element of that as part of the ceremony. I'm not sure.
ICANN is behind something called the Cranes of Memory campaign. What is that and how can people participate?
You can go to ICANN's website, icannw.org, and look it up. But it's essentially about looking at some of the Hibakusha stories and picking one and deciding that you will adopt that memory, that story, and tell it to other people and hold that memory. And people who do that can fold a paper crane in memory of that Hibakusha and show that on social media. It's a way of memorialising and making it personal for people to know the stories of at least one person who was impacted by nuclear weapons. That's happening in conjunction with the Nobel Peace Centre. Yeah, it's a very important project. We've also, just before the 80th anniversaries, we launched an online children's peace memorial to pay tribute to the 38,000, estimated 38,000 children killed in the nuclear bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And it's a way of drawing the world's attention to the fact that these were children and this happened to them, and that's unacceptable. Yeah, so it sort of profiles 400 of these stories of these children. It's in English, some photos there of them as well. And it's a really beautiful, beautiful sight. And I encourage people to look it up and to see for themselves. It's just Children's Peace Memorial.
One of the things I do is I get the Japan Times online every day. And quite frankly, I've been shocked because I have not encountered a single story that has dealt with the anniversary of the bombings. Is there awareness? Is there publication about this in the media in Japan? Or do they try and look another way and gloss over it, as horrific as it was, because of whatever political or media decisions have been made?
Sorry, are you saying you're not seeing any media attention on the anniversaries?
Not from Japanese media. Now, admittedly, they do not post the entire paper, so there may be things there that I don't see. But the headline stories are always there in the Japan Times, and I went through it for today and the last 2 days before and did not find a single article that dealt with the fact that we were at the anniversary of the bombings.
I can only imagine that maybe they had a whole other section on it somewhere that you didn't see, because in this country, the Japanese media is 100% focused on the anniversaries and the bombings and the legacy. They are interested in everything to do with the nuclear bombings. And, you know, to the point where I kind of feel I've treated like a bit of a rock star here, which is an unusual kind of sensation to be followed around by the media and so forth. But no, that we had a press conference when we arrived the other day, and there were a lot of media in the room. No, the Japanese media is very interested in this, and the Japanese public. And so, in fact, the political decisions by the Japanese government on the treaty, on maintaining extended nuclear deterrence with the US, goes completely against what most of the media and public opinion is on the bombings. So it's quite extraordinary, in fact, the government's, Japanese government's kind of imperviousness to public opinion and to media attention on this matter, because they would be so popular if they were to join the TPNW. But they don't, out of a fear of presumably upsetting the US, which I just find extraordinary. Yeah, so there's a lot of attention in Japan, and it's great because my comments about nuclear weapons just get faithfully reported everywhere, which is great. It doesn't always happen like that in media elsewhere, but here that's how it happens.
Always important to get the media out there, and it's wonderful that your perspective, your comments are being echo chambered out to the world so that they can have a different perspective than what's coming from, say, the United States government.
Yeah, well, it's true that the mainstream media doesn't get a lot of information. They memorialize the bombings, the victims, but there's no focus on nuclear deterrence. There's no focus on really the perpetrators. It's like there's just these events that happened here and we feel sorry for the Japanese victims, but then it's totally without context. That's how it's presented in most of the mainstream media around the world. I think that hopefully that will start to change now that there's more questioning of deterrence going on in places like the meetings of states parties of the TPNW. And, when you've got half the world's countries that have joined this treaty and more coming on soon will be a global majority. And that's something that the nuclear armed states can't continue to ignore forever.
Is there anything we haven't covered that you would like to put forth today as a closing thought?
I think always the most important thing is to remember that disarmament is achievable. Humans built nuclear weapons, humans can dismantle them. All it takes is political will and leadership. And currently, that leadership's coming from TPNW states parties and civil society. And we need the other countries to step up, particularly the nuclear armed states and their allies.
Melissa Park, I'm deeply grateful that in the midst of your busy schedule, I think busy is an understatement, but your highly pressured schedule at this time, that you found this generous amount of time to be with us. And I want to thank you so much for being our guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby, and thank you for your tireless work in this area. It's much appreciated.
Melissa Park, Executive Director of the Nobel Peace Prize-winning International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN. We will have links up to the ICAN article on deterrence that she cited during the interview. We will also have links up to the Children's Peace Memorial and Cranes of Memory. Regarding nuclear near misses that Melissa mentioned, there was a film made about Russian soldier Stanislav Petrov. It's called The Man Who Saved the World, and indeed, he did. We interviewed the filmmakers for episode number 223 of Nuclear Hot Seat, and we'll link to that on the website as well. It's the true story of a harrowing nuclear near miss that we survived only because one man, when called upon to push the button, didn't do it.
Activists, shout out, shout out, shout out.
To mark the 80th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, on the morning of August 6, more than 30 peacemakers from the Washington metropolitan area held a nonviolent witness commemoration prayer service at the Pentagon. It was organized by the Dorothy Day Catholic Worker and co-sponsored by Pax Christi USA and close to a dozen additional peace and nuclear abolition organizations. During this prayer service of remembrance, repentance, and resistance, two of the participants, Bill Frankel Streit and Steve Baggerly, received a blessing from the group and then, wearing symbolic sackcloth, walked to the main entrance of the Pentagon to continue the witness. Pentagon police warned them to disperse or be arrested. Bill and Steve remained and were taken into custody by the Pentagon police, charged with disobeying a lawful order and preservation of the property. They have been given an October 16 court date in the U.S. District Court in Alexandria, Virginia. Another story for Jack Cohen Joppa and the Nuclear Resister. A global call to action has been issued by a coalition of trade unions and peace groups demanding democracy that delivers peace and prosperity for all. A joint statement anchored by the International Trade Union Confederation, Greenpeace International, the International Peace Bureau, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, Oxfam, and 350.org, that's quite the lineup, and signed by 17 peace, justice, and disarmament groups, was released just ahead of the commemoration of 80 years since the atomic bombs were dropped on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There's an extensive article on this which points out both the problems and the possible solutions. We'll link to it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 373. In an unusual piece of activism, a doll carrying the sign "Remember Hiroshima" showed up in the middle of the Disneyland It's a Small World ride on Sunday, August 3rd. Who was behind it? Ben & Jerry's co-founder Ben Cohen, who did it as part of his new Up in Arms campaign against the U.S. weapons budget. In a statement, the ice cream activist said, "Yes, we put a Japanese doll that said Remember Hiroshima onto the It's a Small World ride at Disneyland. Why? It is the 80th anniversary of the bombing, an important reminder of what war does to kids. Hiroshima was a city full of children, tiny, happy bodies full of promise one moment and murdered the next. The current, already built U.S. nuclear arsenal can kill everybody in the world several times over. And yet, our government is planning on spending $2 trillion on a whole new arsenal. $2 trillion? And we don't have money for health care and homelessness and education? We can build a world that actually looks more like the utopia in It's a Small World. A world made for children, not for war." We will have a video taken of that doll with Remember Hiroshima on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 737. It will be right next to the video of Stephen Colbert and The Late Show responding to the story of proposed nukes on the moon with a parody to Fly Me to the Moon entitled Put Nukes on the Moon. When it comes to nuclear, take your laughs where you can get them. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, August 12, 2025. Did you know that you can get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week? We make it easy for you. It comes right to your email inbox if you sign up in the yellow opt-in box that pops up anytime you go to nuclearhotseat.com. In that yellow box, put in your first name, a working email address, and bam, every week you will get one, just one, email from us with a link to that week's show as soon as it posts, plus a short description of some of the content. It's the easiest way for you to make certain you don't miss a single episode. And you can participate in the show as well. Because if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, you can send that information to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We read them all and sometimes get our best leads this way. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need the help. Things have gotten thin out lately, and any amount you can provide to us is going to help. We appreciate and are deeply grateful for your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, nuclear weapons are not the path to security. Getting rid of them is the path to security. Melissa Park of ICANN. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.